You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded in the evening of Saturday, the 12th of April, 2025. Some of you know I have several books on the way, the most important being a thorough examination of the Russo-Ukrainian War of 2022, and the other one on the destructive influence of Peter the Great and Feofan Prokopovich on Russian history. And you have plenty of Russian royalists, Russian nationalists who believe that Peter's influence was very rough, very difficult, but necessary, and that's a falsehood. And you have two angles that you could take this from, the political and the religious, being Russia being an Orthodox country. The religious angle was extremely important. That was the realm of course, Peter and the Bishop Feofan Prokopovich. Politically, of course, it was Peter himself and this army of Westerners that he brought in. Most Russian historians in the pre-revolutionary era, with a few exceptions, but most of them saw Peter as a malignant influence. Sergei Platonov, one of the great historians in Russian history, made it very clear that Peter loathed, in fact despised, Muscovite antiquity. His reform was based on German Protestantism. He, saw Russians, and this is, by the way, an assumption. Now, I've dealt with whether or not it was Peter that came back from his grand tour, the Grand Embassy of Western Europe. There's some very good reason to believe it wasn't. But that was a long time ago. I talked about that. I'm not going to deal with that now. Whether it was the same Peter who came back or not, the ideology was exactly the same. The causes may have been different, but the ideology was the same. By the time Peter died, many Russians, I'm willing to say even most Russians, saw him as Antichrist or a forerunner of Antichrist. Ivan Solonovich, another great royalist writer, Lev Tikhomirov, another one, see Peter as a malignant influence. Peter hated the idea of the Third Rome and attempted to wipe it out of Russian consciousness. See, the problem is Russian history, from the royalist nationalist point of view, skips over Peter. The attempts throughout the 18th century to destroy the Orthodox Church are often simply glossed over. You had a substantial severance of any kind of canonical regularity, both politically and religious, during the time of Peter and afterwards. Masons had taken over the country. Prokopovich, who was the either de facto or de jure head of the church under Peter, was a materialist. Many of the men who ran the so-called Holy Synod that Peter created were atheists and high-level Masons. You didn't have any canonical regularity whatsoever. Peter did what the Bolsheviks almost did, of course, just with much fewer resources. And this comes straight out of the Old Believers' schism. The state taking over everything, at least as far as the new capital in St. Petersburg was concerned. The destruction of old Russian traditions. I mean, it wasn't thorough. That was impossible at the time. But Lev Tikhomirov, his article of the contradiction of principles in the error of Peter, He says the state principles of every people are closely connected with its national self-awareness, with its ideas about the goals of its existence. Karamzin says that in the Muscovite era, that is to say the Petrine era, were made very gradually, quietly, almost unnoticeably, without any outbursts of violence. Yeah, there were certain borrowings, as every nation in the universe borrows, but it was always transformed and made Russia's own. Peter simply put the principles of Alexis into hyperdrive, or even Mikhail for that matter. There were certain foreign customs that weren't terrible. But the cost of Peter's reforms negated anything positive that may have come out of it. Solonovich says that the state structure of the enormous Muscovite Empire was far superior to the state structure of Peter's. It was torn apart by feudal and dynastic internal wars, religious persecution, saw the peasantry, especially after Peter, as two-legged cattle, something that Peter the Great's reforms imported into the country. This was a revolution. The title of my book on Peter is The Demiurgos, The Demiurge. Peter imported Western Protestantism and its, whether it be Grotius or Hobbes, directly into the country. Moscow did not have any inferiority complex. It was not a secondary society anywhere. Moscow had a very strong sense of identity. Peter's Russia did not. Moscow was the Third Rome, the last stronghold, the guardian of orthodoxy in the world. Peter's promotion was something very different. It was simply a European empire. Peter would love, you know, Peter's revolutionaries came from the West, were imported from the West. Many of them were very ignorant on what Russian culture was. He brought in masonry from the West, which by the middle of the 18th century, after Peter's death, took over through Lord Byron. They thought that this was just a very primitive society. Of course, it was nothing of the kind. It had a very strong sense of identity, and therefore you can't simply impose something else on top of it, as the Petrine mentality thought. This Petrine idea of mechanically transplanting into Russia this alien form of state and an alien form of culture, which ended with Bolshevism, this foreignness, this attempt, this utter destruction, attempted to destroy old Russia, almost destroyed Russia both religiously and politically, even socially. Dostoevsky fully agrees with this. In his Diary of a Writer in 1876, let me quote Dostoevsky here. In a word, the questions, although radical, were terribly worn out. The main thing here, a long-standing, ancient, old, and already historical fear of daring through the possibility of Russian independence. Previously, at one time, these were liberals and progressives and considered as such, but their historical time has passed. Now, it is difficult to imagine anything more retrograde than what they represented. Meanwhile, in their blissful stagnation on the ideas of the 40s and 30s, meaning 1840s and 30s, they still consider themselves advanced. Previously, they were considered Democrats, but now it is impossible to imagine more squeamish aristocrats in their attitude towards the nation. They will say that they exposed only the dark sides of our people, our nation, but the fact is that while exposing the dark, they ridiculed everything bright. And one can even say that they saw the dark in the bright. They didn't see here that light, that is dark. And indeed, if we analyze the views of our Europeanizing intelligentsia, then nothing more hostile to the healthy, correct, and independent development of Russian dress and customs can be invented. Now, the point of saying that was subsequent to him saying, this is what Peter wrought, this is what Peter imported. The Slavophiles, of which he was sympathetic, came from that strata of Muscovite Russia. They did not want to be transformed into Europeans, and despite the very odd point of view that the Slavophiles had towards the old right, they were really on the same side. They may deny that, but they were. Dostoevsky said, I believe that for many our Slavophiles are like those who fell from the sky, do not trace their lineage back to Peter's reform as a protest against everything that was incorrect or fanatically exclusive in it. Pushkin said something very similar. If you go to my book on Russian literature, you'll see in my essay on Pushkin what he had to say about the Petrine era. So he gives this assessment in the pre-Petrine era, the Muscovite Russia. Dostoevsky says this: Tsar Ivan Vasilevich made every effort to conquer the Baltic coast, but 130 years before Peter. If he had conquered and taken possession of his harbors and ports, he would inevitably have begun to build his own ships, as Peter did. And since they cannot be built without science, science would inevitably have come from Europe, as it did under Peter. It is too clear and understandable that everything that is done according to the known laws of nature and history, and that it is not the feeble-mindedness, the baseness of the abilities of the Russian people, or shameful laziness, that is the reason for our having produced so little in science and industry. Such and such a tree grows in so many years, another in twice as long as it. Here everything depends on how the people were placed by nature, circumstances, and what they had to do first of all. In this case, the reasons are geographical, ethnographic, political. There are thousands of reasons, all clear and precise. No sane mind would approach the same 13-year-old for not being 25. So-called passive Russians, they were inventing science, displayed no less astonishing activity. They created a kingdom and consciously created its unity. They fought off enemies for 1,000 years, who without them would have descended upon Europe. The Russians colonized the further edges of their endless homeland. The Russians defended and strengthened their outskirts, their borders for themselves, and strengthened them in a way that we cultured people will not strengthen now, but on the contrary, maybe even undermine them. Russia before Peter was active and strong. It had developed for itself and was preparing to consolidate its borders. It understood to itself that it carried within a treasure that you could find nowhere else, orthodoxy, the keeper of Christ's truth. But already the true truth, the truth itself, the real image of Christ, was obscured in all other faiths and in all other peoples. And this is something, of course, that Peter didn't understand. The work of Boris Boshulov says very clearly that the cultural development in Peter's time was insignificant. He brought in roughly 1,000 books translated from foreign languages, but Peter's reforms didn't contribute culturally speaking. If anything, they delayed the development of Russian culture for half a century. But far from the surviving ancient stone churches, we can judge that Russian architecture developed with rapid speed prior to Peter, exceptionally and quickly freeing itself from the imitation of Byzantine and Bulgarian architecture. G.K. Lukomsky writes in his book called Russian Antiquity, "The era of Peter the Great divides the history of Russian art into two periods that differ sharply from each other. The second is not a continuation of the first. The path along which development proceeded in the first period is suddenly interrupted. The work that had already led to known results seems to begin anew, in a new environment and under new conditions. There isn't any continuity that characterizes the development of art in other places." The truth is, and all these writers agree, that before the emergence of the USSR, there is no single event or single era in Russian history that leaves such a heavy, oppressive impression as that era that followed the death of Peter. No European life ever came out of Russia. Russia began to resemble the country that had existed before Peter very little. Peasants were turned into slaves. The upper class of society ceased to remind the Russians. The gentry, created by Peter, had forgotten even how to speak Russian and spoke some bizarre version of French or German. A representative of the educated class in Muscovite Russia, you could point right to the great Avakum. The Petrine mentality saw him as a defender of as a blind zealot of antiquity. But Avakum wrote as well as Pushkin did. Nothing came of Peter's efforts to raise the cultural and economic level of contemporary Russian society. Many of the translations were very poor. They simply lay in warehouses for a long time. No one wanted them. Just like no one wants to buy books on Lenin and Stalin today. Most of these books were later used to bind other ones later on. Karamzin, a great Russian historian, prior to the revolution, wrote about Peter the Great, and under him, the Russians who belonged to the upper crust of society, quote, became citizens of the universe and stopped being citizens of Russia. In the Petrine era, you had an entire revolutionary movement, almost an accusatory literature trying to combat the national faith, the national forms of power, national culture. Tatishchev, Theophan Prokopovich himself, Pushkov, so many others. But this came directly from the European rationalists, from Boyle to Hobbes, Pufendorf, whoever. Translated literature had a corrosive and corrupting effect on Russian society. The Serbian writer, Bozic, he said in a conversation to the Metropolitan of Suzdal, Ephraim Janković, being in Russia in the Petrine era, he says, "We thought that Moscow had better piety than ours, but now there's worse. There's iconoclasm. There's worse iconoclasm than Lutherans and Calvin. Some new heresy is beginning that not only do they not honor icons, but they even call them idols. And those who worship them were lost and blinded. The man who had an apartment assigned to me is some kind of doctor, and it seems not stupid in politics, but he is a terrible blasphemer against the Orthodox Church, demeaning the holy icons in the priestly rank. Every evening, young people come to him, and they say that they're students of some German school where he teaches his heresy. He speaks so abusively about the priestly rank and monks and old Russia, you can't even speak to him." So, this was pretty rampant, because just a generation earlier, they would never say anything like that. No foreigner would ever say anything like that. As I've said, and all these other authors say the same thing, Peter I is the first Russian revolutionary. You may want to say, maybe it could be Nikon, that's a possibility. But he certainly didn't have the lasting effect politically and culturally as Peter did. And one of the main reasons for this is that Peter, first of all, was a Gnostic and a Freemason, which is what Petrograd was, the floating city, the attempt to conquer nature, to use slave labor, the Cossacks, captured in Peter's endless wars, to force them to dig out and build this city. No different than any Stalinist camp. It was essentially a Gulag camp, except there was no attempt to educate them. They were simply goyim. They were simply slaves. Literally, Petersburg was built on their bones. That's no accident. Solonovich has his famous book, The People's Monarchy, or The Popular Monarchy. But even Pushkin said that Peter is Robespierre, Napoleon together, the embodiment of the revolution. Liberals like Herzen, who, although he did convert later, understood Peter the Great in the same way. Herzen and Pushkin had the same point of view. By the end of the 16th century, he said, a bold revolutionary, gifted with vast genius and unyielding will, appeared on the throne of the Tsars, a despot, on the model of the Committee of Public Safety. The greatest sin was this break, and this was both the Petrine era and the era immediately after Peter, so-called Catherine I. Russia was ruled by an oligarchy, the two Annas, again, Freemasons, Byron, etc., ruled the country simply as almost a mafia organization. Because of all this, you had the greatest sin, the break between the monarchy and the population, the break between the monarchy and the nation. The Slavophiles, of course, were some of the most articulate in condemning Peter and the Petrine era for this. There was an attempt to rebuild what had been lost. Unfortunately, the otherwise great Nicholas I saw Peter as his idol. Someone like Tsar Nicholas II did not, although it was more or less obligatory to talk about him. Remember, Peter is listed in the church as this holy man. He's listed as the holy monarchs of Russia. The beginning of Lent, he is read out. I mean, it's an outrage. Russia was conquered. It was a coup that Peter carried out. It acquired the features of a revolutionary movement, no different than in Paris. It was a master-slave relationship. Mezhikovsky wrote about Peter's, what he called spiritual Bolshevism, even before the revolution, he said, Pushkin already noticed a similarity between Peter and Robespierre. And in fact, the so-called reforms of Peter the Great are a coup, a revolution, a rebellion from above, a white terror. Peter was a tyrant and a rebel put together, a rebel in relation to the past, a tyrant in relation to the future. Napoleon and Robespierre together. And this rebellion is not just political, it's not just social, but even more, a moral revolution, a moral rebellion, a merciless, albeit unconscious, breakdown of all the categorical imperatives of the nation's conscience, an unbridled revaluation of the highest moral values. It's not going too far to say that the Bolsheviks finished what Peter I began, the breakdown of the Russian soul. Now, I blame Peter, all of these writers blame Peter. It wasn't just him, however. It wasn't just Metropolitan Theophon. It were those who came after him, ruling in his same spirit. Peter imported an entirely new, very foreign and alien nobility. There was really no nobility prior to, at least not formally, in Russian society. But there was after Peter. It's not fitting for anti-communists to admire Peter, who was the first Bolshevik, at least in a spiritual sense. Reform is a modification of something that already exists. It's done in a spirit of respect and usually done slowly. Tradition is always being reformed. That's perfectly normal. But we need to define what a revolution is, and I'm very careful with my language. Revolution is the complete overturning of everything that existed before. It is inherently totalitarian. And it's not just the state that's altered. It's the entire society, even right down to the language and the psychology. It's the hatred of what existed before and an attempt to destroy what existed before. That's not reform. That's revolution. The goal of every revolution, by definition, is the total slaughter of the traditions and those defending them that existed before it. But after the October Revolution, you had a lot of support or an increasing drive amongst intellectuals, such as they were, to look at Peter the Great as a spiritual ancestor. Professor Karsalvin, I did a whole lecture on Karsalvin. He wrote an article on the essence of orthodoxy in the collection Problems of Russian Religious Consciousness. Let me quote from it directly here. Bolshevism is rarely combined with fruitful practical activity. It conceals poison under the guise of necessity. Such as the Bolshevism of Peter the Great, Bolshevism, the destruction, which is covered by the grandiose work of the reformer, is nevertheless clear to a careful examination in the rationalistic breakdown of historical way of life and the destruction of its foundation, the Russian Church itself. It is necessary to understand the new history of Russia, not just a continuation and development of what was begun by the great revolutionary, but as a struggle with him, the last phase of which seemed to be experiencing in the eradication of a creatively sterile Bolshevism. Even the Jewish convert, Frank, he says the origins of Russian nihilism go back to the free thinking circle of nobles under Catherine the Great, that is, to the French Enlightenment of the 18th century. But in a certain sense, this nihilism has even more distant, a more distant predecessor in Russia, and that, of course, is Peter the First. He was the first Russian nihilist. The Bolsheviks, during the last robbery of churches, were happy to refer to his example because Peter did the same thing, and we'll talk about that more specifically here in a minute. Karsalvin talks about Bolshevism almost as a reactionary force in the sense that it wants to amplify and continue the work of Peter, its purely destructive tendencies. Marxism was Judaic and European. It had nothing to do with Russia, the Russian Empire. Socialism, Marxism, Bolshevism, these were foreign imports. We're not talking about Reformation here, your typical revolution. Revolution is not an act, it's not a fact of life. It's a political and social doctrine that claims that society should be founded on the will of man, Not God, not natural law, not anything. Only the Revolutionary Party, only the vanguard, places sovereignty in the party's reason, not human reason, in the party's reason, not divine law or anything like that. The revolution starts from there. The rest follows from it. It's pure will, the uprising from which the modern state emerged. Capitalism emerged. State that has seized the place of everything. State in the very broad sense, not just, you know, government officials, but the complete eradication of social life that came before it. The regime, as I use that term, it's not just the state. That becomes a deity. Now, of course, counter-revolution is the opposite principle. To be a counter-revolutionary is to be a Christian and basing doctrine on logos. A revolutionary, by the very structure of what it is to be a revolutionary, cannot accept logos. Hence, it is a Judaic manner of thinking. Revolutionary movements, when they take over, it has to be preceded by this same movement in the area of religious and political ideas. Peter's church legislation was based on the destruction of the foundations of both church and royal authority, not just in the doctrine, not just in the canons, but the mentality that went to create them. It wasn't the 20th century that saw this occur. The 17th and the 18th saw this occur. Didn't come from below. Revolutions rarely, if ever, come from below. It comes from above. Peter carried out a revolution that was comprehensive. Remember what a totalitarian is. What totalitarianism means, it's a doctrine that claims that everything, every aspect of life, no matter how minute, is amenable to political and social regulation. That's how American law is. There is nothing in American life that isn't regulated by some legal doctrine, by some court case. Peter's reforms is, to refer to it that way, is a misnomer. The death penalty, always used very liberally by revolutionaries. Keep in mind, too, the way that revolution, the term revolution, is defined makes it automatically a leftist idea. It's pure rationalism. The death penalty was used constantly. Under Peter's father, for example, the death penalty had 60 crimes, had that as a possible punishment. In France, prior to the, you know, in France, maybe 115 crimes were punishable by death. Peter's revolution saw that go up to 200. Even in the production of, you know, even to make crimes, anything having to do with the continuation of Russian tradition could lead to a death sentence. That's indisputable proof that Peter's revolutionary movement was based on terror, because all revolutions are based on terror. Terror is inevitable. It doesn't come from reforms, which is a peaceful transformation of things, but the revolutionary modification of life. Schubart, many of you know, a Westerner like me who was a strong Russophile, he said this: since the time of Peter I, Russian culture has developed in alien forms that did not grow organically from the Russian essence, but were forcibly imposed on it. Thus arose this phenomenon, the pseudomorphosis of culture. The result was a spiritual breakdown, noted in almost all life manifestations of recent generations. That disease, whose fever, at least indirectly through self-defense, has now seized the entire population of the globe, paroxysm of world historical proportions. Ivan Solonovich, he correctly notes, the era of Peter, no matter how you evaluate it, is a sharp and almost unprecedented turning point in Russian history. Only the Battle of Khalkha or the October Revolution can be compared with the significance of this revolution. It was the end of Muscovite Russia, an entire historical period with all that was good and bad in it. It began the attempt to import European liberalism, European nominalism, European empiricism, the Petersburgian idea, the imperial idea, which ended with the October Revolution. And at the center of this turning point was the personality of Peter, not necessarily Peter as such, although of course he personally was very important. it was a movement through his who he imported that started directly from him. All of Peter's reforms dug a tremendous, tremendous chasm between these eras, pre-Petrine and Petrine Russia, that goes right up to the October Revolution. We can't begin in a lecture or even a book to catalog how destructive this was. But because of any chasm like that, and it was bad enough what happened in the Alexis Nikon period, of which Peter comes out of, although in a more extreme way. Instead of a single nation, which is something that Muscovite Russia could brag, could boast, two peoples, completely different, faith, worldview, even language and clothing. For a long time, Petersburg, it was illegal to wear Russian clothing, the traditional Russian clothing, or beards. Peter had pagan statues all over the place. It was only the great Saint Mitrophon, the bishop, who finally was able to talk him out of this. The initial plans had, pyramids and everything else that really were outraging too many people for Peter's taste. Peter almost completely destroyed the national form of monarchical rule, which was quite popular. Given Russia's conditions, it's really the only government possible. But it is in correspondence both to much of the Old Testament and natural law. But of course, there are many other variables at play. It'd be one thing if these sacrifices brought benefit. It did not. The Russian population fell in Peter's era and immediately afterwards. The wars never ended. Peter was almost a Maoist in the sense that he would just throw divisions and armies at the enemy. Massive losses for the sake of very minor gains. Yeah, he won quite often, but these came at a huge price. The revolution came strictly from above because all revolutions come from above. It was the opposite of populism. And many peasant uprisings, of course, right up to Pugachev under Catherine, and many in between, Cossack and otherwise, came as a direct result of this because all revolutions create civil war. Now, it's going too far to say that the Petrine Revolution destroyed the spiritual uniqueness of what we call Russia. It did not turn it into a European country. But rebuilding Russia from what was done to it, especially in the middle of the 18th century, we'll talk about this here in a minute, but there is an army of new martyrs, bishops and clergymen who fought this movement throughout the 18th century who went to their deaths because of it. That has to be dealt with. There has to be a segment of saints called the new martyrs of the Petrine yoke. There was nothing left of the episcopate. Peter replaced everybody in the church, replacing them with his own people. The church was never quite the same again. The Petrine era was the prototype of what Dostoevsky would call the Russian intelligentsia in his mocking way. Solonovich also wrote another book that I often overlook called The White Empire. Talking about Peter, he said he was, in essence, an anachronism in reverse. Your typical Russian intellectual of the 1860s, the Pisatov era, the rationalist, the semi-atheism, the free thinker, the sower of so-called reason, and on and on. Muscovite Russia was not on the edge of any abyss. Peter brought the Russian state to the edge of an abyss. He weakened the Orthodox Church even more, who had already been weakened by the schism. He was not a popular man among the common folk, and certainly the old believers saw him as coming directly out of the schism. The old believer movement took over the peasantry the way it did, primarily in the Petrine era. Not prior to it. But now I want to talk about Feofan Prokopovich. I've spoken about him before. I've mentioned him many times. But he was the religious leader of Peter's revolution. He had a tremendous influence over the church. He had an extraordinary influence on the episcopate. And of course, a man who was a complete heretic in every way, shape, matter, form. He outlived Peter. He died in 1736. He was one of, if not the central figure of the Petrine Revolution. He was probably the most influential intellectual of the Russian 18th century. He dominated Russia in his lifetime and westernized its theology to an extreme. He was, as his name suggests, he was Ukrainian in origin. He was born in Kiev. He was within the Hetmanate. He was born into an Orthodox family, but for his education, he became a uniate. The Vladimir Uniate Collegium, he actually was tonsured as a uniate basilian, and he took the name Alicia at that point. Then he went to Rome, the so-called missionary Catholic Academy of St. Athanasius. The entire purpose of that academy was to spread Catholicism among the Eastern Slavs, specifically the Russians, and had plenty of Ukrainians there. He reconverted to Orthodoxy when he got back to Kiev, and he began teaching at the Kiev Mohyla Academy on many subjects, poetics, philosophy, and theology. He wrote, his influence, he wrote many teaching manuals for the future, which were used for some time. But even as early as 1706, he wrote a novel, sort of a tragicomic novel called Vladimir. And that gets overlooked quite often. He mocked the clergy constantly as promoters of superstition and ignorance, which is why Peter saw in him a kindred spirit. To say that he worshipped the state in the way that Thomas Hobbes would is not going too far. I mean, it may have been purely self-interest on his part. But what caught Peter's eye was his sermon in 1711 on the Battle of Poltava. It wasn't just its eloquence and everything, but it was that it saw the state as a central religious entity, not the church whatsoever. From then on, Prokopovich became an absolutely fanatical supporter of Peter. Now, despite his Catholic education, Theophan drifted more towards the Lutheran Reformation. And from there, the scientific revolution of Thomas Hobbes, Francis Bacon, Descartes, etc. And he knew them fairly well, intellectually speaking. He liked the idea of Lutheranism from a political point of view, because he loathed the notion that anything should have political influence over the state, that any other power, like the Pope or Patriarch, should ever be considered equal to the state or be equal to the state. He completely rejected, and this is a bit contradictory, but he rejected the idea of the clergy having any authority over intellectual life. It's almost as if he didn't see himself as a clergyman. It was just a useful costume to wear. And he was saying this even when he became the highest clergyman in the country. 1716, he was summoned to the new capital of Petersburg with the explicit purpose of starting a campaign, a philosophical campaign against old Russia. Peter brought in many Ukrainians, many Englishmen, Germans to staff this new revolutionary movement. Like revolutionary movements in Russia, from then on, it was mostly foreign. The church had to be swept away. He had a sermon in 1718, fairly well known, called the Sermon on the Power and Honor or Virtue of the Tsar. That was his first major intellectual offering on what some historians in a cliche way call enlightened absolutism. What that means specifically is that the state, in the name of democracy, by the way, in the name of republic, the state has to become powerful enough to destroy all the enemies of the republic. Now, Theophan was a royalist, but not in the traditional sense. It was just a matter of power, not virtue, not natural law. He rejected natural law. It was about smashing the old elite. And this isn't the same thing as smashing the oligarchs, as you saw in Ivan the Terrible, Ivan IV. That was not the issue. It was the elite as such. anything that stood in the way of the utter centrality of the power of the state. Theophan, personally, was extremely brittle and extremely arrogant and used the harshest methods to destroy his opponents. He could do so intellectually in certain ways, but usually he used force. Clichés like Caesaropapism or enlightened absolutism, that doesn't really tell us much. But it's enough to say here that the earthly crown, having no interest, having no, not answerable to God, the canons, or anything else, but given the Hobbesian argument, the social contract and maintaining peace, that that should be the final word in everything spiritual, political, moral, or anything. 1721, he published a treatise. He liked these very pompous, long-winded titles. And this one was a historical investigation of why and in what sense the Roman emperors, both pagan and Christian, were called pontiffs or bishops of the polytheistic law. That's only a part of the title. The rest is just, you know, it's a waste of time. Very long. But it became the central, the official statement of the Petrine view of things. It's from there that Peter, along with Theophan, abolished the Patriarchate and created the so-called Holy Synod, the Collegium, in 1721. And one of the many obnoxious things that came out of that, and most of the saints in the Russian church from then on rejected it, the oath to be a part of that, to become any part of the episcopate at all, was, among other things, the oath was very long, but I profess that the ultimate judge of this spiritual college, synod, is the all-Russian monarch or all-merciful sovereign himself. Theophan was installed. He was never elected. There was no canonical way in which he became bishop of anything. 1718, he was bishop of Pskov, but he never lived there. He lived entirely in Petersburg. Whatever title he had, he lived in Petrograd. He was not really a monastic. But one of the most important acts of in church affairs, which he wrote and compiled by on behalf of Peter, among many other things, of course, was the spiritual regulations of 1721. The legislative and intellectual side of the revolution came from Theophan. The Sermon of the Power and Honor of the Tsar, as I mentioned, very important. Even the naval regulations of 1719 came from him. Nothing was beyond his perceived ability. He wrote on the teachings of the youth and family, marriage, baptism, the truth of the monarch's will in determining the heir to his power, many other things. He rewrote the entire intellectual world of old Russia. Now, the leader of the first synod, the collegium, was another bishop, Stefan Yavorsky, who became an opponent of Theophan. But when he died, shortly thereafter, in 1726, Theophan then dominated the life of the church completely. I say he wasn't really a monk, although he had professed it. Peter was lavished him with villages, a huge income. He built entire villages with his own money, of course, using serf labor, a huge a farmstead and the Karpovka River. Stefan Yavorsky became an opponent of Theophan, also Ukrainian, by the way. He was really worried about his rapid and really unmerited rise to power and his blatant, absolutely blatant heresy. Theophan saw himself, for the most part, as a Protestant. He hated Orthodoxy. He saw the German movement, but especially the Swedish movement, Protestant movement, as his model. Now, he had a deistic point of view in the sense, I'm talking about Theophan, that God is the basis of all existence, but it ended there, he thought that matter could not be created. It was not created by God. That was a classic Masonic point of view at the time, in the early years of Masonry. God was not the creator of matter. Matter is eternal. He very vaguely talked about nature as the creator of the laws of matter, and that is as eternal as God is, but different from him. He was a complete nominalist in every way. He rejected Plato. And there were moments, depending on what you read from him, that he comes straight down to materialism. That everything at least, or at the most, everything is material, or at least derives from the material. Now that can justify his political point of view. But as far as Peter was concerned, it wasn't really necessary. His whole career, like all of these guys, was based exclusively on imperial patronage. Now, once Peter died, a bitter struggle emerged against Feofan, because by this point, he alienated everybody in the church. Now, many of you know that when Anna rose to power, the first empress, the oligarchy had taken over. Anna was a very weak woman, wasn't sure what she was really doing. This was an incredibly tumultuous time in the country. The oligarchs came to Anna and said, you know, we'll back you ruling here. You can have all the dresses you want, which was her big priority. You can have all that, but we're going to limit your power. That really nothing happens, especially in foreign policy, without our okay. This was a huge division. Theophon pounced on this. He hated this idea, because as rotten as these men were, they would have gotten rid of Theophon. He then took Anna aside, which was very hard to do, given she was surrounded by these people, and said, reject these. He wrote her rejection of these conditions, which would have destroyed the monarchy permanently. The oligarchy wanted to limit a fairly weak woman, but Theophon was very eloquent, and he was able to convince her otherwise. It was a positive thing to do, but he did it for all the wrong reasons. Because of that very Machiavellian pouncing, he saw the area of weakness. He saw what he can do. He could flatter her. And from then, for the rest of his life, he had another very strong position, both at the court and the synod. Without the crown, at any era of his life, his power would have been zero. And this was when, he always was like this, but this was an even more, he sent many bishops to their deaths. The clergy that Theophon had murdered number in the thousands. There's an entire group, as I said, of new martyrs to this man. Just a handful include Theophlact, Lopatinsky, for example. These are all bishops. George Daskov, Ignatius Schmola, Sylvester, Konski, Varlam, Vonatovich, many, many others. That's just a handful of the bishops at the time who went to their deaths. And many of those men were simply installed in their positions. Many of these men and many more died terrible deaths, possibly even in the dungeons of Petersburg. What makes me laugh, and this has come up before, even some of the English language literature, 1734, he brought as his assistant, Bishop Joseph, from Georgia, kind of to give an Orthodox rubber stamp, despite the fact that Joseph didn't speak any Russian. But, as Flavsky and many others have stated, now Peter's revolution had been institutionalized by this point, so now his job was to defend it. Even if he disagreed with whoever was in power, he would rhapsodize over them. It didn't matter. His funeral service when he died in 1736, September 8th, funeral service was done by this very same Vicar Archbishop Joseph. But his last words allegedly were an ode to reason in the rationalistic Masonic sense, seeing himself as the last interpreter of reason. And now he says, where will you lay your head? He wasn't talking to God at all here. His significance was as a fawning executioner of Peter's policies. He was quite servile. He was influential in the sense that he was able to give force, intellectual force, to Peter's policies, making sense out of all of them. Because Peter was very, he didn't sleep much. He was very demonic in the sense that he, you know, he was a constant flurry of activity. Now, his regulations, spiritual regulations and many other legislative things, they weren't really regulations. They're not legal codes. They're treatises. It became influential for this very reason. It was more a justification of what he was doing, the Petrine ideological program. It was a political and legal set of pamphlets. Much of it full of a very contemptible denunciation and criticism. It's a manifesto, as many have said. Official obedience, political reliability. The government was rushing through so much. Theophon was the person who kind of, at least at this point, made some sense, gave it a rational outline. But Theophon had a personality that was so caustic. It was nothing but bile and venom. He hated his opponents. What he did often was out of spite, contempt for old Russia, which he really had nothing to do with. Now, in many ways, I mean, in his doctrine of the college, the collegium, he refers it as the Sanhedrin, the Areopagus. This was his model for this. And when the Patriarchate was overthrown after Adrian's death, he wrote, it's often attributed to Peter, but in fact it's Theophon. He wrote, "From conciliar governance, the fatherland will not feel rebellions or confusion which comes from its own spiritual ruler. The common people don't know how the spiritual power differs from the autocratic power, but amazed by the great honor and glory of the highest patriarch, they think that this man is a second sovereign, equal in power to the autocrat or even greater, and that the spiritual rank is another and even better state." That's one of the most famous lines or paragraphs of his regulations and of the Petrine Revolution. He saw the common population as incredibly ignorant, very beneath him, incapable of being able to distinguish the, you know, the patriarch and those around him from the monarch. That to him was a huge problem. It was a crazy justification of the fact that he wanted to smash the spiritual power entirely. This was the core of his justification of destroying the patriarchate. Because maybe some people may see the patriarch as a second monarch. And that outraged him to such an extent that it had to be abolished. It's amazing that no one had noticed this before, but it really was a puerile justification. He didn't hide the fact that he was deliberately undermining any conception, any high opinion of church leadership among the people. I mean, you read between the lines here, and he wants it humiliated. He doesn't want the state to have anyone, or the monarch in Peter's case, to have anyone to challenge it. He says that there should be no excessive brightness as a metaphor for them, that the spiritual rank is secondary. Russia is not a spiritual society. It's a material one. It's a Hobbesian one. I mean, he's not really talking about conciliar government in the sense that we normally use the term. He's talking about collective rule. But only. It exists only under the monarch's crown. That anyone, and he says this as well, that anyone who wants to rebel, and he's talking about rebellions that occurred before based on the old belief, and everything that goes along with it, this revolution was extremely unpopular. You had foreigners, even after Peter's death, being huge landowners, completely altering the nature of serfdom. It was humane prior to this. It wasn't humane for this period of time. It was more like Poland than old Russia. he says over and over again that the governing collegium, in other words, the Holy Synod, exists because of the sovereign monarch, is established by the monarch, and is therefore under the command of the monarch. Which is another way of saying things like the canons don't matter if the monarch has a problem with it. No one can rise against the true lord of Russia, which is the crown. You know, the word Christ means the anointed one. The monarch is also the anointed one. So he used this as a play on words, even saying that the monarch is Christ because he's anointed. It's an equivocation, of course. It's a play on words. But this is how he expressed himself. It's no shock that many Orthodox people, all believer or not, saw Theophan as the Antichrist, or a precursor of the Antichrist. But the Kievan movement, coming from the West, had this as a core idea. This is one of the reasons that Elizabeth, I mean, there were great holy saints, of course, at this period of time from Ukraine, many of them destroyed by Theophan, by Peter and Catherine, etc. But he was not the only one talking like this at the time. His main theme in everything was the boundlessness of the state's power. I don't even like, you know, he used phrases like royal and the crown, but he meant it in a Hobbesian way. He rejected any tradition that created a monarchy. The pomp of that was just to manipulate people. There was no holiness in it. There was no holiness at all here. His work, The Truth of the Monarch's Will, or The Virtue of the Monarch's Will, which came out simultaneously with his regulations. And in 1721, he came up with another one of these long-winded titles. And I'll say this out in full. Very awkward title. Historical Investigation of the Faults for Which, and in What Sense, Were the Emperors of Rome, both pagan and Christian, called pontiffs or bishops of the polytheistic law? And in the Christian law of Christianity, can sovereigns be called bishops, and bishops in what sense? Bishops or rulers in what sense? Very similar to the one I've already mentioned. In other words, there is really one bishop here, and it is the emperor. And it doesn't matter whether that emperor is pagan or Christian, he has the exact same power over whatever the religious system happens to be. The monarch is a bishop, which he says very clearly, and higher than that, the bishop that oversees all bishops. He uses the anointed one metaphor very ambiguously and equivocally. The other one is not just anointed, but also the concept of overseer. Here's what he says in this treatise. He says, the sovereign, the highest authority, is the perfect, meaning wanting for nothing, extreme, supreme, and all-effective overseer of all, that is, having the power of command and extreme level of judgment and punishment over all ranks and authority subject to him, both secular and spiritual. And since sovereign, the oversight of the spiritual rank is also established by God, for this reason, every lawful sovereign in his state is truly the bishop of bishops. So in a way, this was a conception of the papacy, just without any reference to any canons whatsoever. Foreign opinion saw this as the Reformation. This was a Reformation, a sort of a semi-Lutheran, a rationalistic attack on Russia carried out by the crown, which existed solely for Machiavellian reasons. Some variation of the social contract. Now, the revolution failed over time, but it took many thousands of holy people with it. Spiritual regulations was not a program of reform whatsoever. It wasn't feasible over time. Orthodoxy remained what it was, but it was severely damaged. The Reformation, regardless of where it took place, was a revolution. It was based on external violence. The church shrunk by a great extent in numbers. It did not find any kind of sympathy in the church consciousness. Now, I keep in mind there was protest all over the place, but given that Theophon was an executioner, it was very difficult to pull this off. There was a lot of indirect attack. Theophon liked to believe that this was just blind worship of antiquity. Stefan Yavorsky was one of these people. Yeah, he would, you know, he would talk about how wonderful Peter was. But when Theophon began the destruction of the church, reducing it, you know, Peter wanted to outlaw all of monasticism entirely. Theophon did too. Of course, that was very difficult to do in a, you know, in space of, say, 20 years. He was completely alien. I mean, he was not Russian, did not see himself as Russian. He saw himself as a Western Protestant. St. Philaret of Moscow says this, you know, he despised the, you know, of course, this is later, 19th century, he despised Theophon and everything that he stood for. That this was Masonic, this was Lutheran. And that was the mentality, he says, that created this collegium. Only later on was the collegium called the Synod. Because they didn't want people thinking that this was a purely secular body, although Theophon wanted it to be. Keep in mind, though, that the regulations, it didn't have any canonical force. It referred to nothing. It would only refer to any, you know, canon or church father just as a practical matter, given the nature of his audience. Anybody who joined the synod or became a bishop at all had to swear the oath of allegiance to the ultimate judge. It was not Christ, but the anointed one, Peter, the ultimate judge of this spiritual college. That was only abandoned in 1901. It was a pseudomorphosis. It was because the so-called synod existed only because of the monarch. The church itself existed only because of the monarch. Flosky and many others call this the Babylonian captivity of the Russian church. He calls it the intimidated class what the clergy was. Theophon was a mercenary. He was an adventurer. I'm not sure he had any real beliefs whatsoever. Florsky talks about, talks about him as just ultimately insincere. He was extremely dishonest. Despite his education in the West, the only thing he really took out of this was the worship of the state, the very opposite of what the papacy wanted to be. The Reformation in the reformers in, well, the revolutionaries in Germany and Sweden saw him as their champion. So January 25th, 1721, Peter subordinated the Orthodox Church, which he despised, to the state. He secularized the Russian state. It wasn't merely destroying the patriarchate, but it was belittling the church as a whole. Now, we all know the church is not its bishops. The bishops are servants of the church. But Theophon or Peter didn't see it that way. He wanted to demote the very concept of a church as a spiritual entity and reducing it to a mere matter of practicality. When he was destroying monasteries, I mean, the monasteries were reduced by half by the time Peter died. Clergymen reduced by half, at least, when Peter died. I want to quote a professor, Zizekin, who was a historian of this era. Again, one of many who agree with this interpretation. He says, Peter's church reform was a destruction of the very foundations of the church and of Russian life. After Peter, Orthodoxy ceased to be the determining element of state building in Russia. It continuing to exist determined the life of the masses of the people. Flourished in monasteries, hermitages, gave holy ascetics, but it was no longer the element that bound the state together, which would have swept away the influence of any philosophical systems, gradually replacing each other. Peter and Theophon rejected the church as such. It saw it merely as a utilitarian body. This pagan patriotism, there was no conception of holiness or even of beauty. It was iconoclastic. Peter despised and was and said so, the notion of the Patriarchate or even the Bishop's Order. Theophon also knew, though, that in order for the state to function in this period of time, he needed the state to be sanctified somehow, but only in the sense that it would complete its secularization for him. Holy Russia didn't exist. Only the state did. It wanted to create just another large European empire. Peter also hated the canons, confiscating huge amounts of church property. The church did not have its own goals or identity. Before Peter, the Russian state always, except for the Nikonian period, of course, that was an exception, relied on this symphony, the voluntary union of two forces, the state and church, just like the human and divine natures of Christ. Very similar. Now, it's very difficult to destroy an entire national tradition in 30 years, but that was the attempt. When the Freemasons under Byron took over after Peter's death, and around the time of Theophon's death, they shut down churches in huge numbers, even large ones. Ultimately, this is where, later on, the Pugachev Rebellion came from. Not realizing, of course, that this was sawing off the branch that you're sitting on. The state was justified only in that way. It was a comprehensive revolution. It was pure Protestantism, leading, of course, to indifferentism and eventually atheism. The English theologian converted to Orthodoxy, Palmer, he said, "Russia is now an empire in which the German element, with its noble religious indifferentism, is the head. The Greek religion now is tied to foreigners." I mean, by that he meant Freemasons. The church prior to this was an independent institution, was a check. It developed parallel to the state. Now it had been humiliated to render it merely just another bureaucracy. This is why the old believers flourished like never before. This is why they had huge numbers. The majority of the peasantry, maybe even more than that, become one branch of the old believers or another. This was a bureaucracy of physical coercion that was elevated to a system, is one way of putting it. In Theophon's thinking, there was no teaching about the church. The church was not a body that had anything to do with what the state or even society was. When he was forced to define the church early on, here's what he said. God wanted to unite his faithful, restored through Christ, into a certain citizenship or republic, which is called the church, so that their own would better know their own, to mutually help one another, to rejoice that with God's help, defend themselves against their enemies. He never went any further than that. That, of course, is completely insufficient. You're never going to hear anything about grace. You're never going to hear, except in the most simplistic Protestant point of view. And even that, he doesn't mean it in the way that a normal person would mean grace. There is no mystic element. He despised that. It's merely a mutual aid society. He came out and said, he called himself a Protestant in many ways, and he said that only the scripture, as he defined it, that was the only source of doctrine, which ultimately means nothing. Given the nature, by scripture, he only means the books of the Bible, however many he thought were there, probably 66. Because that depended on how the state would use it. That's the first step towards the complete destruction. Iconoclasm isn't just smashing icons. It's destroying the entire Orthodox culture, and he was well aware of this. Church fathers had no bearing on this. It was merely his interpretation of the books of the Bible that he thought was important with the end goal of destroying it. He was a scholastic, but only in the sense that he was a rationalist. In his collected works, he talks about pure justification only as a matter of grace, but that very quickly becomes moral virtue, not any religious element whatsoever. He rejected almost theology as such. Theophylact Lipotinsky, who I mentioned before, he rejected openly a lot of what Theophon was doing, calling him a materialist, which he was. And Theophon, of course, was also very, very clever. He wouldn't approach this intellectually, or at least not theologically. Any time, especially after Peter's death, someone like this would speak out, he went straight to what he created, the secret chancery. And he ended up, these guys ended up in dungeons and prisons all over the place. The way that he put it is very Judaic. Someone would reject something like his theology or the synod. He would go to Peter or a bureaucrat close to Peter and say, this man is anti-Rush, is anti-state, anti-royal. He wants to overthrow the state. And hence, he's a dangerous subversive. There was never any theological discussion. This is not how these kind of revolutions worked. Any theological reference was just a diversion. And it all came under the war against what they called superstition. Superstition was anything beyond facile references to scripture. And you see it in his very first novel in Vladimir. Anything that the priestly class would do, anything within the Orthodox tradition was a superstition. That includes icons, that includes incense, that includes any of this stuff. He hated a ritual, a miracle, ascetic feats. He called them idiocies. He came out and said, with the best powers of my soul, I hate the mitres, the cassocks, the candlesticks, the censers, and all of these other amusements. He said in a letter, this was the ruler of the church, and this was the man who sent hundreds of bishops and archimandrites to prison. Up until the confirmation of Elizabeth, now I've done an entire lecture on Elizabeth Petrovna, attempting to reverse this, kind of like Mary, Queen of Scots in Britain, for the Catholics. Under the Freemasons, there was an official Protestantism, which was preached from Petersburg. Ambrose Yuskevich, in Anna's time, he said, talking about Peter and Theophon, and this was under the rule of Byron, by the way, they attacked our piety and Orthodox faith in such a way and under the pretext that they were not eradicating faith, but an indecent and very harmful superstition. Many theologians and clergy, especially scholars, were exterminated under such a pretext. Monks were defrocked and tortured. Peter's justification that they were superstitious, bigoted, hypocritical, good for nothing. All this was done with such cunning and intent in order to completely exterminate the Orthodox priesthood in Russia and start their newly invented priestless regime. I mentioned Yavorsky, his famous book, The Rock of Faith, which rejected much of this, was not published while Peter was alive because it was a very anti-Protestant book. It came out only in 1728. One of the reasons that Bishop Feoflot Lipotinsky was murdered was because he approved it. 1732, the Rock of Faith was banned and withdrawn from circulation. Bishop Ambrose again said, our domestic internal enemies have composed some kind of strategy to shake the Orthodox faith. They have locked up ready-made spiritual books in darkness and have forbidden others to write under the death penalty. Not only teachers, but also their teachings and books were bound, forged, and locked in prison. And it has already come to the point that our Orthodox state is dangerous to open our mouths about our faith. Troubles and persecution would immediately follow. In other words, Orthodoxy was officially banned as much as humanly possible. It was only in 1741 that Yavorsky's books, or any Orthodox books that defended the faith, were freely permitted, especially in, you know, the cities. Byron said he was a Masonic Lutheran and imposed this on Russia. Bishops came and went. You had entire dioceses, large numbers of dioceses that had no bishop for a long period of time. And many at the time said there are no parishes in certain parts of Ukraine. This was pure, violent iconoclasm. This was the attempt of total destruction of Orthodoxy, nothing less than that. This was a legacy of Peter the Great and Fyodor Prokopovich. An army of new martyrs were created. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.